So the book of Revelation, dear brethren and sisters, is given to show us these things that must come to pass, and it is for our part to hear that message. But can we hear it? Can we indeed accept what is said? As we get into chapter 2, as our brother has just read for us by way of introduction, it is sad and it is disheartening for us to have to come to realise, my dear brethren and sisters, that not everyone in the ecclesias will hear and respond to the testimony of Jesus Christ. In the seven ecclesias which are represented in chapters 2 and 3, I believe that they are representative of the Gentile ecclesias, as they were the ecclesias in Asia. But in these seven ecclesias, there were those who certainly were not the servants of Jesus Christ. We have false apostles, as they are described. We have false Jews of the synagogue of Satan, as it describes them. We have Balaamites, Nicolaitans. We have that woman Jezebel. You see, brothers and sisters, these were not perfect ecclesias. As you go through them, it's horrifying, really, as you look at it, to think that these are seven ecclesias where these things are going on, and yet the Lord says that he still walks amongst them. Some things that you would think should have been rooted out maybe a long time ago. But here they are, brothers and sisters, and they are here for us to take note of. And as I say, they certainly are not perfect ecclesias. They are ecclesias which some of us, if we had to belong to them, might feel a little bit uncomfortable about. For example, in the ecclesia where that woman Jezebel taught those doctrines that she taught. Wouldn't be very comfortable being in an ecclesia like that. And for that, it doesn't matter what you think about who it was or anything, but the point is, there was teaching that was tolerated in that ecclesia which seduced the servants of Jesus Christ. It did, it says so. It shouldn't have been tolerated, but it was. And so we get, brothers and sisters, these ecclesias that are set out before us, and you know, you have to come to the conclusion that in these ecclesias, these seven ecclesias that are presented to us here, you have both true and false disciples. The community was mixed. They were mixed together, as you have it represented here. What other conclusion can you come to? And that, brothers and sisters, is a situation which we must not be surprised at. If you turn back to the second letter to the Corinthians, we find that the Apostle Paul makes a comment which we should learn from. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 19. Except it isn't chapter 11 verse 19. It is... I thought it was chapter 11. Something gone wrong here. All right, what I'm looking for is the verse that says that there must be heresies among you that we might be made manifest. 1 Corinthians 11. Of course it is. We read it every Sunday morning. 1 Corinthians 11. That's the one. Thank you very much. Yes, that's it. For there must be also heresies among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest among you. Thank you very much. That word that we've got there, brothers and sisters, where it talks about heresies, do have a look at it in your concordance and lexicons. You'll see that the meaning of it is sects, parties. That's the idea of it. I think it was Parkhurst's lexicon that said that it was based upon the old Greek schools, and where you'd have sort of a university type situation, I suppose it would be, where you would have certain philosophers and you would have schools of thought. And that's the idea in this word heresies, that you've got schools of thought, sects, parties. And the Apostle Paul is saying that, look, he says the brotherhood's going to be like that. You're going to have schools of thought that's there. And we might look at our own community today and say, well, is that the case? And we have to say, well, yes, I suppose it is, really. We do have this group that think that, and we have this group that think that, and we have this group that think that. I mean, that is the picture. Well, the Apostle Paul tells us, look, he says, there's a reason for this. And he says, the reason is that they which are approved may be made manifest among you. Well, brothers and sisters, as we look at the scene then, and we decide, we realise that we're not a lot different, perhaps, to the first century ecclesias in many ways. Don't let's get discouraged by that, because there is a reason for it. And rather than being cast down and discouraged by it, rather let us take this exhortation from the apostle and be stirred up by it. To be stirred up that we, individually, you and me, that we may be made manifest. We want to consider, my dear brothers and sisters, what our response must be in this kind of situation. And it should encourage us to stand for what the truth is, and to try to help one another where there is difficulty. And I believe we could do a lot more to help one another than perhaps we do sometimes. Rather than standing in corners, pointing fingers one at another and saying this about that lot and this about that lot, rather, brothers and sisters, it would be a lot more sensible and it would be a lot more brotherly, wouldn't it, if we could come together and talk about these things and discuss them, so that we may be able to be made manifest. That's what it's about, you see. What sort of things should we do? Well, if we go to those two chapters in Revelation, chapter 2 and chapter 3, we will find that there are certain instructions given to us. I don't have time this afternoon to give you a thorough exposition on chapters 2 and 3. And so, may I suggest that sometime when you're looking for a little subject of Bible study to do, go through these chapters, chapter 2 of Revelation and chapter 3 of Revelation, and just take a notepad and go through carefully looking for positive instruction of what you're supposed to do, and make a list of what it is the brethren and sisters are supposed to do in this situation. You find it very profitable. Just picking up a couple of examples. Chapter 2 and verse 25, for example. Hold fast till I come. Now, they're simple words, but it's something you've got to do. You've got to hang on. You've got to hold fast. Do a little study of that. See where it takes you. But that, in a nutshell, is one of the things that we've got to do. chapter 3, verse 2. It's quite a bit here. Be watchful. That's one of the things you've got to do. And it means to be alert. Be aware of what's going on around you. Strengthen the things that remain. Now there's a positive thing again. That's what we've got to do. Try to strengthen. We can bewail about this and that and the other and moan and groan about it. But brothers and sisters, look what we're supposed to do. Okay, let's take what we've got and let's strengthen those things which remain, which are ready to die. We don't want them to die, do we? So strengthen what remains. And there is the rebuke there that follows. Chapter 3 and verse 11. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. So again, brothers and sisters, there is something for us to do. And as we go through these chapters, we see the various things that we're supposed to do. Chapter 3 and verse 3, I missed that out. Remember, therefore, how thou hast received and heard. Brother, sister, go back in your mind to the time when you were baptized. Remember how you came to receive the truth. However those circumstances may have been, I mean, I don't know, it would be different for all of us, no doubt, but remember how, and perhaps we should say what, remember how you received and heard, and hold fast to that. And so we go on and we read these various things. I'm not thoroughly going into this, brothers and sisters, but just to give the point, and as I say, take a notepad and go down and see of the positive things that we're supposed to do in the situations as we have them described here. We come out with some very good things to do. But there are also, brothers and sisters, some things here which are notably absent. There are things that we might have thought, perhaps, we might have thought, that we would have been told to do. And yet we're not. For example, there is no instruction here to abandon a dying ecclesia, is there? Honestly, it just isn't here. We're not instructed to do that. Neither are we instructed ever to split an ecclesia. We are not instructed to cause a division in any shape or form. Why aren't those instructions here? Why are they not here? There must be a reason why they're not here. May I suggest, my dear brethren and sisters, that they're not here because it would be wrong to do those things. It would be against the Spirit of Christ. That might be hard for us to accept, but let us remember, brethren and sisters, that there is a commandment, and that commandment says that we are to love one another. And if you love one another, how can you leave the sheep? Do you remember the parable of the Lord Jesus Christ? About the hireling? And he said, the hireling leaves the sheep, fleeth because he is a hireling, and careth not for the sheep. That's why he left. Now, brothers and sisters, we can't be like that. No, sorry, we cannot be like that. We cannot leave the sheep. We have to hang in there. We have to do what it says here. We have to hold fast that which we have. We have to work hard. Sometimes maybe under very difficult circumstances, perhaps. But we have to strengthen what remains. We have to remember how we heard. In other words, we have to remember our roots and hold on to those things. You see, Christ's mission was, in case we forget, his mission was to save, not destroy. There will be that work to do when he comes back, we know that. But in his work on earth when he was here, and as he is set before us as an example for us in this life now, our whole objective surely should be to try to do everything we can to save our brother. Not that we can save our brother in the ultimate, of course. That's Christ's work. But we can help, and believe me, we can hinder too. Well, brothers and sisters, maybe that is how we should be towards one another, and we should carry on these principles and try to put them into practice in our ecclesial life and maybe in our inter-ecclesial life as well. What of ourselves? Let's now look at our own personal, individual sort of case. Well, you know, in these epistles, there is one message that comes shining through all the time. And let's just take it up in chapter 2 and verse 7. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the ecclesias. We dealt with that in our first talk. Then it says, to him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. And that exhortation, to him that overcometh, is repeated right throughout the two chapters. It's said to every ecclesia. That message goes out. To him that overcometh. And brothers and sisters, in some way, you and I must overcome. Because that is, time after time after time again, it's telling us we've got to overcome. It's telling us, hear what the Spirit says to the ecclesias and overcome. And that's what we're getting all the time. Hear what the Spirit says, overcome. Hear what the Spirit says, overcome. And the Spirit is telling us to do certain things. And we better be about doing them. And he's telling us to overcome. But what are we to overcome? I have known brethren and sisters sometimes that feel very discouraged at this exhortation to overcome, because like you and like me, they know what flesh is. And ask ourselves a question, brothers and sisters, will we ever, as long as we are in this mortal flesh with its nature that is pulling us always to that tendency, will we ever come to a point in our natural lives when we will be able to say, right, yippee, I've done it, I've overcome, got it made now? Oh, you know and I know that that can never happen as long as we're in this flesh. So we ask the question, what is it that we've got to overcome specifically? It can't be overcome the flesh, because you can't. Eventually you will, when the Lord comes, and if we are found worthy, immortality will be granted, and we know with that comes a new nature, that's the way it will be. But in the meantime, it's not possible. But perhaps there is something of a little hint for us if we look at chapter 3 and verse 21, where the Lord says, to him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. So we've got to look at the way, and we've got to look at Jesus' own overcoming. That should be obvious to us. And so to do that, we go back to the Gospel of John, chapter 16. John chapter 16 and verse 33, Jesus says to his disciples, these things I have spoken unto you, that you might have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. So that's what Jesus overcame. And if we are going to overcome even as he overcame, perhaps we ought to be thinking in terms of overcoming the world. Overcoming the world, the cosmos, that's the Greek, this arrangement of things, this system that is around us, brothers and sisters, the social, political, religious environment in which we live. This is what we've got to overcome. And in order for us to overcome, we need faith, as the first letter of John, chapter 5, verses 4 and 5 teaches us. This is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. And so there is, it would seem, a way for us to overcome the world. Now, brothers and sisters, we do not have the time, unfortunately, to expand this very much this afternoon. We want to try to do what we can very briefly, and I do hope that you will bear with me if we take some shortcuts for a moment. But just to try and get this into gear, as it were, we want to try to have a look at it. You see, if we're going to overcome the world, we've got to realise some basic principles, which I'm sure we do, but nonetheless, we must just mention them as we pass. First letter of John, chapter 2 and verse 15. Love not the world. Know the words well, I'm quite sure. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man have the love of the world, if any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And we've got to realize this, that the world passes away. Young people, these things in the world are going to pass away. You might spend all your energies and efforts and everything getting in my day it was an E-type Jaguar, I don't know what it is these days, but you know what I mean, you get that fancy looking car, because everything you've got goes into that car. Well, by the time you get my age, it's a heap of rust, it's gone, it's passed away. But if you've put your efforts into getting, not a Jaguar E-type as it was in my young day, but if you put your efforts into getting, or shall we describe it as treasure in heaven? You know, if you put your things in the things of the truth, that doesn't pass away. As a matter of fact, it gets more and more valuable as you get older and you realise, you know, you start the countdown. You know, normally I've got 20 years left, 15, 10, 5. You know, you start this countdown, and then these things of the truth, brethren and sisters, these things are eternal. And they will strengthen us and give us fortitude as we come to the closing years of our life, perhaps. Where's the Jaguar E-type now? All gone. So, brethren and sisters, this is where we've got to put our efforts. Don't love the things of the world, they're passing away. And it's all born of the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, and all those things, we know that. So these are things that we've got to try to overcome then. This is the sense. And really, you know, this is what the book of Revelation is all about. You might think it's all about beasts and difficult things to understand and one thing and another. When it really gets down to brass tacks, it's about us overcoming the world. And these things are revealed in here to help you and to help me to overcome the world through faith. That's what it's given to us for. But you see, these things in the world are not spelt out to us. They are signified. And in the ecclesias, as we read of it in Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3, we find that the influences of the world in the ecclesia are signified. We're given a sign language to tell us about them. For example, we read in our opening chapter 2 about Nicolaitans, didn't we? When you take a concordance and you look up Nicolaitans, and it's just, if you want to make a note when you get home, it's number 3531 in your concordance. And you will find that it tells you that it means, it's a name that means victorious over the people. That's what Strong's Concordance tells us it means. Now, as you go to your scriptures, you've got to think about this, and you realise that it's not that strange, really, that it's a title which we can pick up from other scriptures. If you want to look at Jeremiah 33 and verse 1, you will find this. Woe be unto the pastors, or the shepherds, if you like, that destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, saith the Lord, or Yahweh. So here you have got, then, shepherds who destroyed the people. They were victorious over the people. Here are your Old Testament Nicolaitans, if you like. And they had them in the ecclesia in the first century, in those ecclesias in Asia, as it tells us. You've got Nicolaitans there. And so you see, brothers and sisters, what we have, just like in Israel, you can look at the pattern that's established there for us in Jeremiah and see what these false shepherds were up to. They were destroying the people. Well, surely the message is that, I'm afraid to say, that in the ecclesias you're going to have a similar sort of a situation. They're going to be there. You're going to have Nicolaitans. If you want to see an example of a New Testament Nicolaitan who wanted the victory over the people, I would like to suggest the third epistle of John, verses 9 and 10, where you are introduced to an individual by the name of Diotrephes. And you see, Diotrephes loved to have the preeminence. That was his problem. He didn't love the truth. He loved to have the preeminence. Do you see, brothers and sisters, what was at the root of that? The pride of life. The pride of life was at the root of that problem. And you know, and I know, that here and there, sometimes, that spirit is manifest, isn't it? See, the Nicolaitans weren't in every ecclesia. You had Nicolaitans in a couple of ecclesias, then you had Balaamites in something else, and you had Jezebel people in something else, and so on it went. But you can look at these things and you can see that they have meaning. Now the first thing is, it doesn't cause us to stand back and look at everybody else to see where the Nicolaitans are. Now you know, we've got one over here, we've got one. The first thing it should cause us to do is to look right here. Am I one of these people? Search self, you know, that's where it's got to start, isn't it? And we search self and say, have I got any of these tendencies? If I have, Lord, help me to get rid of them. That's what we've got to try to do. And get these things out. There was the synagogue of Satan. There was a group, it seems, in the ecclesia there, who the Spirit describes them as the synagogue of Satan. Have a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 11 sometimes and learn about the ministers of Satan. Transformed into angels of light, they were. This is the picture that we get. As I say, brothers and sisters, we don't have time to go into all the different aspects, but that's the sort of thing we find. And what I'm saying is, don't get discouraged by this. Do what you're supposed to. Do what the Spirit tells you to do. Get those positive things worked out what you're supposed to do. And maybe there are sometimes negative things. And we have to think carefully, don't we? If that woman Jezebel happens to be around, whether she should be suffered to teach and to seduce. Have to think about those things. Might seem hard, but there are cases for it. Well, we must overcome this influence of the world that comes into the ecclesia. And brethren and sisters, you know and I know that the influence of the world coming into the ecclesia via whatever means it might come in these days is one of the big problems we've got to try to cope with. Many of us are worried sick about the influence of the world, particularly upon our young people, though not always upon our young people. And it is there, and this is what we've got to recognise. As brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus, we do have a joint enemy. And that enemy is the influence of the world. It's made clear to us. We ought not to be enemies one of another. Our enemy is there, and it's the world. And we've got to cope with it. If there are any in our midst who would wish to bring the influence of the world into the ecclesia, we've got to do what we can about that. If they can be helped, we help. If not, we have to obey what the scriptures say in order to keep that down to a minimum, don't we? We move then, brothers and sisters, to look at this situation, and you might think that, well, all right, Revelation chapter 2 and 3 might be about overcoming, blessed is he, you know, to him that overcometh and all the rest of it, but the rest of the book of Revelation isn't like that. Well, just looking at this overhead here, we see then Revelation chapter 2 and 3, overcoming the influence of the world within the ecclesia, that's what it's about, really. That's the exhortation. That's what we're being told about. But as we get into the body of the book, we get just overlook chapters 4 and 5, which are is a special vision. We'd have to talk about that separately. But you come to chapter 6 of Revelation. And as soon as events start moving, shall you say, the seals start to open, you get the first seal is opened, and in verse 2 of chapter 6 we read, I saw and behold a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. Now that word conquering there is the same word as you've been reading all the way chapter 2, all the way through chapter 3 in Revelation. It's the word overcoming. So we've had all this exhortation about to him that overcometh. Events start moving, and the first thing that you see is someone with a bow on a horse, and he's overcoming. That's what it says. He's conquering, he's going forth to conquer and conquering. And he's overcoming and overcoming. He's going to over. He is overcoming and he's going forward to overcome. And that's what's happening. So it continues into the book, do you see, brothers and sisters? If we go over to chapter 12 and verse 11, reading about believers, it says, in relation to this dragon power, this is, we read that they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. And so here you've got a struggle going on. And it's all about the believers, the brethren and sisters, overcoming this dragon power, whatever it is, do you see? But that's what it's all about. It's about them overcoming. If we go on to chapter 15 and verse 2, we read here about the future when we see with the Apostle John a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, over his image, over his mark, and over his number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. It's the kingdom, isn't it? You see, what they've done? They've gotten the victory. And the word victory there is, again, it's the same word. They've overcome. They have overcome the world. And I hope you can begin to see, brothers and sisters, that what we've got here is the world, but a specific aspect of the world has been communicated to us by sign. In one place it's a dragon. In another place it's a beast and his image and his mark. And these are signs to specify certain things so that we can identify what's going on. But that's what it's about again. It's about our getting the victory over, about our overcoming. And as a matter of fact, it goes right through to the end of the book, because in chapter 21 and verse 7, the exhortation is there again. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. And so we see that the world is presented to us throughout the book of Revelation in symbolic form. And it's for us, surely, to identify what these symbols are to help us in our gaining the victory, to help us in our going forth to conquer, to help us to overcome the world. Try to just move forward in the time that we seem to have left. Question is what to leave out, I'm afraid. Look, we want to try to, if we can, just briefly have a look at the world as it is represented to us by beasts, because there's one particular aspect. I guess I should have shown you all the overhead. Forgot it was on, sorry. Just in case anybody wants to make the notes there. All right, we want to try, if we can, to just have a look briefly at this. And to do so, and I hope it will be obvious to many of you, we're cutting a corner here, to understand this beast in Revelation, there's just something about it I want to try to point out. And to do that, we must go back to the book of Daniel, where we meet this beast. All right, it's Daniel chapter 7. And in Daniel chapter 7, we meet a ten-horned beast. Do you remember the principle that I tried briefly to explain at the end of the first class? How that you take a symbol, you see a symbol, and you try to think, well, where have I heard of that before in the Bible? And you go back in the Bible and you find a similar thing. Well, it's like that. When you look at a ten-horned beast in the book of Revelation, your mind should be saying, okay, where have we heard about this before? And your mind must go back to Daniel chapter 7, because that's where the ten-horned beast arises first of all in Scripture. And when we go back there, in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7, we find that we are introduced to this beast. And he's there in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth, and it devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had ten horns. And there are ten horns, which we are then told relate to certain kings that are going to come up. What is this fourth beast? In verse 23, we are told that it is the fourth kingdom which shall be upon the earth. Now, brothers and sisters, here is a straightforward equals. All right? Ten-horned beast equals, says the angel, or says the spirit, the fourth kingdom that shall be upon the earth. There's no doubt about that. There's no guessing. It isn't what I think. It's what the scripture says. It says it's the fourth beast. Now, this is the way, surely, that we've got to approach it. Now, the fourth kingdom, as we look at it, now, I know there are one or two questions about it, which, if we had time, we could look at. But, basically taking it, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, it has to be the Roman Empire, doesn't it? So, we come to the Roman Empire, then, as being this fourth beast upon earth, upon the earth, the fourth kingdom. Now, Daniel beheld this beast, it says in verse 9 of chapter 7, I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, the hair of his head like Revelation chapter 1. If you're picking up the vibes from it, there's a similarity there. The pure wool, his throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth before him. Thousand thousands ministered to him. Goes on, 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set. Important words, those. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. And I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn speak, and I beheld even till the beast, this fourth beast, this ten-horned beast, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Now, as Daniel looked at that vision, brethren and sisters, he saw the beast arise, and it was to be the fourth kingdom upon the earth. And we've said that it rather looks like the Roman Empire. Now, that beast is to continue its existence until the Ancient of Days comes and until the judgment is set. In other words, that beast empire must continue its existence until the second coming of Christ, because that's what that's all talking about, isn't it? So it has to, we've got to look for this beast then to continue in some form right up until the end. So it wouldn't be surprising then if we come across him in the book of Revelation, because he is to have a long, continuous lifetime up until the time of the end. And not only so, verse 24, the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings, or kingdoms, dynasties if you like, that shall arise. And another will arise after them, that's 11. But just to get it clear in our minds, brethren and sisters, when we're talking about these ten horns, they come out of, notice the words very clearly, that they come out of this kingdom. So they have to be associated with the Roman Empire in some way. What nations came out of, or emerged from, if you like, the Roman Empire? I think it has to be, as far as I can see, it has to be the nations of Europe, because that is what emerged out of the Roman Empire. There were some other distant parts, granted, but basically, that's what we're looking at. And we're looking at a continuous story in these things, brothers and sisters. It's a ten-horned beast that we now meet in the book of Revelation. And I would like to just take a little time to look at this with you. The little time that we have got left, brother. Daniel's ten-horned beast continues its existence then, and we meet him in the book of Revelation. And the first place that we meet him in the book of Revelation is Revelation chapter 12. And when we meet him in Revelation chapter 12, he's called a dragon. I want you to just notice something that happens here, because in the book of Revelation you meet the ten-horned dragon, then you move into chapter 13, you meet a ten-horned beast, then later on in chapter 13 you meet a two-horned beast, and you've got all these beasts through the book of Revelation. What I just want to show you is how that they are all connected. Because what happens in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 2, if you'd like to just look at it, Revelation chapter 13 and verse 2, there is a transfer of power, or if you like, to a beast of the sea, as we describe him, because he rises out of the sea, and he's got these 10 horns, still identifiable, do you see? But what happens is, in Revelation 13 and 2, is that the dragon gave him his power, or his authority, and his seat, or his throne, and great authority. So there is a transfer of power from the dragon to the next phase, if you like, to the ten-horned beast. So it's continuous on, isn't it, from here to here? Because if in South Africa, if the present government should ever transfer power into the hands of a black majority, it's a continuous history, isn't it, that's happening. Do you see what I mean? It's the same sort of thing. It's a transfer of power and authority, and in this case a throne, from one to the next. So it's a continuous thing that you're looking at. Then we come along and we find that there is another beast appears later on in chapter 13, beginning at chapter 11. This time he hasn't got 10 horns, though. He's only got 2. So we're looking at him a little bit differently. But in verse 12, I want you to notice what it says. He, that's this two-horned beast, he exercises all the power, or the authority, if you like, of the first beast before him. So again, you've got another transfer of power now from this one to this one, because he exercises all the power of the beast that went before him. So it's like at one time Great Britain ruled over this country as it did over Canada, right? But a time came when that was taken away, and it left a government here, independent in a sense. But you see, it exercised, locally anyway, it exercised all the power of the first power that was here before it, if you see what I mean. So that there was a transfer of power from Britain to the South African government, wasn't there? It's the same sort of thing. And so it's, again, if you... I don't know how much people talk about heritage and that in South Africa and Canada, where they do, and they go back to the days of the colony and a little bit of romantic nostalgia about it sometimes, and sometimes not, but anyway. The point is that we've got a transfer of power now, which we can see clearly from here to here to here. And so it must be, my brethren and sisters, that we're looking at a continuous, excuse the expression, won't you? But it is a continuous historic picture that you're looking at as it unfolds, and power is passed from the one to the other, and that's how it's going along. I find this quite a powerful thought. Now, if anybody in the audience thinks otherwise and thinks that, well, I don't think it is quite as powerful as all that, Brother Paul, because of whatever, please tell me about it so that I can think about it. You know, let's look at it. If there's a good, solid reason why what I'm presenting here doesn't make sense, please help me and tell me about it so that I can understand, I can look at it then. But as far as I see, that's what's happening. And so it must be a continuous picture unfolding, as I say. Well then, what happens next? As we come to Revelation chapter 16, we've got that two-horned beast with all his power and everything. Sorry, I can't go into more detail about it. But Revelation chapter 16 and verse 10, as the story continues, you see, we find that the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat or throne of the beast, and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain and blasphemed the God of heaven, it says. And you might notice also it says that they repented not of their deeds. But what we've got here then is this beast's kingdom, which has inherited its power from way back, is now plunged into darkness. That's the picture. So something has happened along the way, and it's been plunged into darkness. But that isn't the end of it. That isn't the second coming of Christ when, what was it Daniel said? His body was going to be destroyed, or he's got the beast was slain and his body was destroyed and given to the burning flame. Haven't reached that point yet. This is just plunged into darkness. So we would expect that he's got to appear again somewhere. And he does. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 3. John says, he carried me away into the spirit, into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and, ha-ha, there they are, 10 horns. The features are there again. This guy's come up again. He's arisen again. What does verse 8 say? The beast that thou sawest was, he did exist before, you know, is not for a while, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. So this guy is making a comeback. That's what's happening. He's making a comeback. And this incredible beast has got to be seen again. So look at the picture on the chart, you see. Transfer of power from this guy to this guy, from this guy to this guy. Then, of course, his kingdom is plunged into darkness. But then he makes a comeback, and here he is again at the end. Now, I suggest, brethren and sisters, that that is a continuous story. It's how the picture is presented to us in the book of Revelation, isn't it? He's come to power again. And so this incredible beast arises. Well, if it was the Roman Empire, and our assumption right at the very beginning was a correct one and scriptural, can we see headlines like this and think that it is of absolutely no relevance at all? When we see the one who occupies anything that's left, I suppose, if anything at all is left of the Roman Empire, with the shadow of it, or the ghost of it, if you like, is seen in the Vatican. And when we see the leader there calling for the creation of a united Europe so that it might be brought back together again, surely we are seeing a comeback. It isn't just an odd thing. This has been quite a policy over since the late 1980s, 1989 that particular paper was. But you see what's happening. So that, brethren and sisters, I cannot for the life of me see a graphic like that appear in Time magazine with all the background that we've got and think, well, that's no relevance at all, that. I can't do that. It's incredible, to my mind, that men should be moved. Now, I realise, of course, that that graphic is based upon the pagan myth of Europa, and we know the myth concerning that and what it has to do with, and so on and so forth. I know all that background. But, nonetheless, when I look at it, it sure looks vaguely familiar from somewhere else as well. And I'm seeing the book of Revelation there. I can't help it. Now, perhaps it's just a coincidence. But here we have, brethren and sisters, this picture before our minds. And the word says, in Revelation 17 and verse 8, that they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that used to exist. That's what it is. The beast that used to exist, he was, and is not, wasn't for a while, and yet, lo and behold, he is again, here he is. Now, that's the picture that we've got, if we can identify. And of course it is the world. That's what it is. It's nations of the world getting together. I don't know if this overhead will show very well. It's a postage stamp. Maybe you can see it. But it's again, it's based upon the same thing. Not just once does that graphic appear, but in many different forms. And so, brothers and sisters, I suggest that we look this fellow right in the eye and we identify him. And don't be frightened to identify him for what he is, what he represents to us. Because here he is. And you know, as you look at the book of Revelation, come with me now to chapter 19. Here he is, he's made a comeback. What next? Well, in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 19, we see him. We see the beast. And we also see the kings of the earth and their armies. And we see them gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army, which, if you read the context, there's no doubt that that's the Lord Jesus Christ. But we read verse 20, that the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that received the mark of the beast, da-di-da-di-da. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. That's the end of the beast system. What did Daniel say? The beast shall be slain, and his body given to the burning flame. It's the same end. So therefore it is the same system. And so, brethren and sisters, what we have got, surely, we can see that we have got a continuous unfolding story about this beast system, which is in fact the lost my original chart now. Where I'd taken it to, oh, there it is. We've got this continuous unfolding story, and it all ends up the same way. So that as I see it, this is Daniel's fourth beast going through various phases as you come through the book of Revelation, till it all ends up the same way at the bottom there. Hope you can see that. I'll just put it up a little bit. Given to the burning flame in a lake of fire and brimstone. What's the diff? There it is. And so we see that there is a conflict with Christ, and this system meets its end at that time. And the saints of all ages, brethren and sisters, have had to overcome their world, and each age has had its specific environment, if you like. For example, our brethren and sisters who lived in the first century, they had to overcome a pagan environment. Now, that's not exactly the same as the environment that we have to overcome. And so you see, there are specific problems, there are specific issues relating to that world in which they lived that they had to overcome. There are some things which they had to overcome that we don't have to overcome. But there are certain things that you and I have to overcome that they didn't have to overcome. And so there is a phase of the world power, as it were, that is brought before us for that generation, for this generation, and then in the Middle Ages when we had the protesters, you know, you've got that time, and then there is the age in which we live. So we can see a continuously moving story where the influence of the world has been a threat to the spiritual life of brothers and sisters all down the ages. And we see the particular form that comes. And it's surely important for us, brothers and sisters, to be able to identify the aspects of this power for our own time. We don't want to, and we must not, cramp anyone's ability to explore the Word of God, to find out the things that are there. But we build upon the foundation that we know to be true. And for myself, brothers and sisters, I must confess that I am convinced that we as a community, if we could become united in these truths, then instead of hindering one another along the way, we could unite our strength and help one another and point out the various things so that we might be better enabled to overcome the world. And don't we need all the help and the strength that we can get? You know, if we what's the phrase now? Divided the, I've lost the wording of it. But you know, if you've got an enemy, if you can divide him, then you'll overcome him, won't you? That's the principle I'm trying to think of. I just forget the phrase. But that's the principle, brothers and sisters. Don't let us be divided. Let us unite together around these truths. If we have to do some discussion and some hard work in coming to understand, well, fair enough. Let's face the challenge and get on with it. Try and get on with a good spirit and come to it. But I think there are things there that we could sort of get much closer together on these things. And then we would be able to overcome, because that's what we've got to do. We've got to see that we can do this, and we're better and able to strengthen one another if we could do that. So, brothers and sisters, with that thought, may we just leave us with the general exhortation then, that if we can read and hear the words, the teachings of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand, then in God's grace we may be strengthened to gain the victory and overcome the world and sit with God's Son in his throne, even as he has promised us. Thank you.